these are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient. Ends and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, here's a litmus test of a certain kind. If I just say the word drone, do you imagine an unmanned plane dropping bombs on a remote village, a little Amazon robot delivering your packages within hours, or a Christmas present that was lost or broken well before New Year's Eve? Drones, in fact, are proliferating at an incredible rate. And one sign of that is a new class of drone pilots. They're not amateurs and they're not military either. They're drone racers flying specialty vehicles designed for speed. And I do mean speed. One of those little drones with four propellers reached about 180 miles an hour in a trial. And so we asked staff writer Ian Fraser to take a look at the sport. And one of his first stops was something billed as the Drone National Championships. This was back in 2016.
2016 U.S. Drone Nationals. Thank you to all of our local corporate and national partners who we'll get to in just a little bit as we make history.
It was one of those things that happened early on in the development of a sport, I guess, in that it was not really very well thought out.
Pilots, goggles down. Arm your copters. We are on the tone in less than five.
You couldn't really tell who was in first and who was in second because drones are small and drones can go really fast. 80 miles an hour is a kind of regular speed. They, when maneuvering gets complicated, they may go down to 60 miles an hour. It was hard to follow, but in the course of it, there were two pilots who I knew about. Anoub is Zachary Thayer. That was his racing name. And Jet is Jordan Temkin. Zach won both the race and also the freestyle competition. So he came away with $12,000. I did follow them starting at that point because they were really exciting and really good racers. And then I found out that they shared a house out in Fort Collins, Colorado. And they were also, there was a third drone guy named Travis, so I went out and visited them.
Jordan.
And I have Travis.
How's it going?
All right. Yeah, welcome.
I am Travis McIntyre.
And I'm Zachary Thayer.
So yeah, we live just outside of Fort Collins on a little 1 acre property. It's pretty much just a house that us three live in, and all we do is drone things.
Has sweet lacy curtains too. Mm-hmm.
They're not really our style, but...
No, they're our style now, man.
Jordan and Zach are both 26. Travis is 31. He does not race competitively very often, although he does sometimes. And this is just a, you know, I think maybe 2-3-bedroom ranch house in a suburban development. They moved there, they said, in order to become better drone pilots. And they succeeded, which is kind of great.
But yeah, first thing that you pretty much see when you walk in the door is this giant wall of trophies.
Yeah, California, Arizona, Dubai, New York. Man, lots of places.
Yeah.
Well, they do travel a lot, and these trophies are from all these different places where they've raced and placed.
And then there's more drones in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
And more drone chargers and...
laptops and more controllers and more batteries. Yeah.
And there's the basement, and the basement is, it was a workshop.
So our drone basement is a bit of chaos, but.
Oh man, this is just amazing.
You got a little video
This is
studio.
Really incredible. This is like a drone fleet. This is just.
Yeah. This is mostly stuff that doesn't really ever fly anymore. So these are like relatively.
These don't fly anymore?
No, so these work, we just never fly them.
We went through a lot of crap.
I thought, you know, the Wright brothers would have recognized this. This would have been like their bicycle shop, you know? They're doing all kinds of different things in this rather familiar place. I mean, what's more familiar than a basement of a ranch house? They have all kinds of equipment for soldering, cables, and plastic milk crates with all kinds of stuff in them. I have 15 or 20 along one wall. that are mostly propellers.
Imagine an entire Amazon truck just rolled over in your house and they're all full of props.
They have a lot of different drones, but there's one drone frame that they have manufactured themselves.
So basically, this is a foot square.
Yeah.
But the shape is, it's like a cross. It's like, and this is a quad. I mean, that would be the term
for it. So quad for motors.
We don't necessarily design for everyone else. We design for what we need. A recent goal we've been working on for a while is we want something that's better for mountains, something that's a little bit faster and maybe can fly a little longer because mountains are deceivingly large. They're going to be a 2,000-foot cliff over there, and we'll be up to the top, you know, in a matter of seconds. But that, you know, requires a lot of energy and different stuff. So we've been trying to perfect the mountain cruiser formula for a while.
I think usually that's the one that they're flying when they're just out practicing. They practice up in the Cache La Poudre Canyon, northwest of Fort Collins. It's a drive, a short drive from Fort Collins. Yeah, it's in the front range of the Rocky Mountains. And so they go up this road up into the canyon, and there are a lot of pullouts along the road.
So this is what we do. We pull off on the side of the road.
Great.
Jump out.
The first place we stopped, we were against a cliff wall, and the road is next to us, and then the river's on the other side. And it's you have the drone at your feet, and then the drone just goes and just goes right straight up out of sight. The pilot is wearing goggles, which are exclusively the feed from the camera on the drone. So you lose yourself in it.
So like Travis right now, he's just an empty carcass of a body standing there. And his consciousness is somewhere flying around this mountain.
You can set yourself challenges, like how close can you fly to the Cache La Poudre River? I mean, they're dodging rocks in the river, and it trains them, and it's good for reflexes, and it's good for a sense of, you know, the drone's capabilities and how close you can get to something and what you have to look out for.
Oh, the wind was knocking me around real good up there.
Yeah. You want to go for a ride?
Okay. They had brought along extra goggles so I could just watch the feed.
You might want to sit here.
It's better to sit than to stand, you think?
Yes.
But I'm already feeling a little nervous about this.
And take the goggles off at any time you feel nauseous or anything.
Okay, okay. You don't think you're going to react, but it's impossible.
Okay, and but I just saw that car go by, so...
Yes, you did. That car did go by.
Okay.
So it's not virtual reality. It is streaming reality... Right? You are just transplanted somewhere else.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Whoa. So I'm now right on top of that ridge that's on the other side, and I'm looking down on all these spires and things. Okay. Okay. Now I'm going along the river, and I went by that big spire that's sticking out there. And I go right down by that spire, and now I'm coming down the road. And I'm going over the river. Man, I'm going over the river. Okay. And this is the fastest I've ever gone over a river.
It's exhilarating, huh?
It's exhilarating. I mean, it just absolutely gets your entire body wired. It's just everything. Everything. I mean, you feel it. I mean, you feel it in your toes and your knees and everything. Whoa! Whoa! Whoa, was that... Did you just flip it over there?
Yeah.
Whoa. You feel like you're about to die. I found it necessary to hold on to the car tightly so that I did have some tactile grounding in actual physical reality. Whoa!
So did you see yourself sitting there? Isn't that
yeah.
a sensation?
It is really strange. Yeah, it feels like you're flying.
And you're so engulfed in just being that drone.
Right. There's no feeling of your own self. It's mostly like what flying in a dream feels like. Mm-hmm. Only I've never had a dream in which I did a loop-de-loop or anything, you know, like spun around.
and we can't stop flying. So
yeah.
A lot of the people who fly are ex-adrenaline junkies. So like skateboarder, I'm a skier. Zach came from a motocross background. Mm-hmm. We know a lot of people from motorcycle, you know, they had a bad motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. And this is their outlet to getting this sensation of I'm going 100 miles an hour an inch from the ground, and it's thrilling. Yeah. And yeah, worst case, I crash and I'd break a $20 motor.
So if you meet somebody just at a party or on the street, and they ask you what you do, what do you say you do?
So that's actually this question that I've been struggling with myself.
I sort of chuckle and say I'm a professional drone racer because it doesn't seem like I should be able to say that or that it's real.
That's cool.
That's still something that's really hard for me to say to somebody. Like, for example, when I bought my car a month ago and I was looking for car insurance, right? They're like, what is your profession? And I went, well, I don't know. And one guy put down artist and one guy put down entertainer. Okay. And I said, all right, entertainer, because I'm on TV. You know, that works.
8 of the best from the whole year.
The best pilots in the world.
I'm here to win.
I can be the best, and that's why I'm here to prove it.
This is drone racing. This is DRL, the Drone Racing League.
Jordan and Zach are pilots who have contracts with a company called DRL, which stands for Drone Racing League, and it packages these races as programs that are shown on ESPN and on other sports networks in 75 countries, in fact.
Main event, Heat 7.
Jordan races under the name of Jet. Zach races under the name of A-Noob. The race courses are in places where there are opportunities for obstacles, for complicated courses. Miami Dolphins Stadium, for example, they've raced in an abandoned mall. And last year's finals were in Alexandra Palace in London.
Next is Palm Court and the Gravity Gate Ascent. Gab, Willie, Jack,
it isn't just a race on one plane. You have to go on this side of a gate. You have to go through that gate. You have to go over to that side of that obstacle. You then go up. And the one race that they had at the Alexandra Palace, there was a loop-de-loop going right straight up. And I think that the fact that Jordan and Zach spend so much time in the mountains made them particularly able to deal with that type of a course and help Jordan to win.
Jet finds another gear. He beats Gab in the U-turn. He takes it. Jet wins it all. Jet is your 2017 world champion.
I'm blown away, Greg. That may have been the greatest pass in drone racing history.
I've always wondered what happened to
giant checks.
Giant checks. You have a stack of giant checks.
Yeah, we got more on the walls.
He won a contract for the next year, and it's a, I guess, six-figure contract.
So he's broke. He's almost broke. And then I have some money. That's kind of the way it is right now.
But last year I did. It's really weird. You can either make money off prizes, which is almost no one does that. Very few people. I was able to do that last year, which was really nice. This year, it's sort of DRL pays us for our time filming with them. Where's the money? There's not much right now. There's a little bit here and there, so you got to sort of fight for it and scrape by.
Zach and Jordan guess that there are probably about 50 pro drone racers in the world, but a lot of people are taking up the sport.
But, you know, now there's a bunch of 16-year-olds and 12-year-olds getting into it and starting to kick our butts around every now and then. But we're still pretty competitive.
I'm starting to fall behind a little bit because there are these guys who live in places like Indiana and all they do is race practice every single day. Mm-hmm. And they're getting incredibly fast and incredibly precise. And if I want to be competitive, I can't just be flippy floppying in the mountains all day long.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a life that you get up, you talk about what you want to do, and you go out and do it. It has to be fun, and it has to be disciplined at the same time. And there's a great part of a poem by Robert Frost, and at the end of it, he's explaining how in his own life, he does not like to take the professional and the fun and separate them. He says, "But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation with my vocation, as my two eyes are one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes."
New Yorker staff writer Ian Frazier. You can find his piece on drone racing and everything that he's written for us, a range of subjects that really boggles the mind, at newyorker.com. Now we're going to close the show with the writer, T.C. Boyle. Tom Boyle is a novelist, and he's written stories and essays for the magazine going back to 1993. That, by coincidence, was right around the time he took up residence in Montecito, California. The town seemed almost like Eden to him then. But Boyle and millions of other Californians have just lived through back-to-back natural disasters, capping a year of weather-related calamities around the country. Tom Boyle wrote about returning home to Montecito a few weeks after the mudslides there.
The eerie thing about those first nights back in Montecito after the mudslides had to do with absence. The absence, first of all, of my neighbors, almost all of whom were under a mandatory evacuation order. They were gone, their houses dark, their cars rolling down other streets altogether. Most homes were without electricity, which brought the darkness close, and the stillness, too. Apart from the sounds of nature, the muffled hoots of the owls come to nest in the woods out back of my house, and the chirrup of the tree frogs enlivened by the first rain here in nearly a year, there was the delicate, almost apologetic beeping of the heavy equipment brought in to clear away the debris. The helicopters were, for the most part, gone. The survivors airlifted to safety, and the search for the missing left to the cadaver dogs. I moved here 25 years ago, attracted by the natural beauty and semi-rural ambiance, the short walk to the beach and the lower village, and the enveloping views of the Santa Ynez Mountains. We have no sidewalks here. If we want sidewalks, we can take the 5-minute drive into Santa Barbara. But we don't want sidewalks. We want dirt, trees, flowers, the chaparral that did its best to green the slopes and declivities of the mountains until last month, when the biggest wildfire in California history reduced it all to ash. On the apocalyptic morning of December 16th, I was on the roof wearing a surgical mask and wielding a garden hose when a great black cape of smoke enveloped all of Montecito and whitened everything with ash until you might have mistaken it for snow. At 10:30, the police were at the gate, enforcing the newly imposed mandatory evacuation order. And I drove up the coast to rejoin my wife, my daughter, and our coddled and oblivious pets. In all, we were stuck in a motel room for 10 days until the order was rescinded, and we were able to return home just in time for Christmas. Rain was forecast for the early morning hours of Tuesday, January 9th, and it was expected to be heavy at times, very heavy. I welcomed the rain, which came on Monday night as a long, gentle, misting sacrament that just barely dampened the streets and shimmered in the leaves of the trees. Feeling celebratory, I walked down to my favorite watering hole in the lower village. And though I barely needed an umbrella, I carried one with me anyway, mindful of the forecast. The rain awoke my wife and me at 3:30 the next morning. An intense, hammering rain that seemed to explode all around us. The sky was brightly lit to the north where the mountains lie. What was it? Lightning, I reasoned. And then my head was on the pillow, and I was asleep. As I was later to discover, the concentrated rain propelled a debris flow down the slopes of the denuded mountains. A gas main had been sheared off, and the escaping methane had exploded in flames, incinerating the houses just below it, even as the debris flow tore into them and raged on past, gathering force and seeking the low ground. We woke to a gentle rain and the wail of sirens, too many sirens, sirens that multiplied one atop the other and kept on multiplying till it seemed there was no other sound. The electricity was out. There was no newspaper. It wasn't until we drove into Santa Barbara for breakfast and news that we began to understand. We were among the lucky ones. Our house, one of the oldest in the community, sits atop a hill, at the bottom of which lies the stream bed of Montecito Creek. Through most of the year, the creek barely lives up to the name. But on that night, it jumped its banks and swept to the sea, taking with it everything in its path. Houses vanished. Trees were uprooted like weeds. Boulders taller than I pounded through the watercourses like the bowling bowls of Titans. A man, who lived just down the street from us, was killed. And his teenage son was swept 3/4 of a mile down Olive Mill Road and across the freeway to the beach. All of this I learned secondhand, through local and national news sources. It wasn't until the 6th day after the storm that I had an opportunity to tour the devastated areas and see the effects for myself. At the bottom of my street, there was a remnant riverbed in the place where once had stood houses I'd seen every day for 25 years. Mudflats stretched off into the distance. In her essay, The Wreck of Time, Annie Dillard speaks of compassion fatigue in a world in which catastrophe and annihilation come as regularly as the progression of the days. Her point of reference was the 1991 cyclone in Bangladesh, which killed 138,000 people and displaced millions. How can we begin to comprehend the magnitude of that, let alone sympathize? These are just figures, digits, symbols on a page. We each inhabit a consciousness, and that consciousness gives us the world and what we can grasp through the apprehension of our 5 senses. But the universe has no consciousness. It just is. 21 of my neighbors are dead. 2 are missing. That probably doesn't mean much to the rest of the world, or for that matter, to you. For me, though, it's personal. And I want my village back.
T.C. Boyle. You can read more of his work, fiction and nonfiction, at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and thank you for joining us today. I hope you'll join us next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Cal Alia, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Corey Schreppel, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.